On the Job with Francis Leach and Sally Rubb.
G'day and welcome to On the Job. I'm Francis Leach.
I'm Sally Rugg, and the views I express here today do not represent those of my employer.
It's important to know that. Sally, welcome to the very first edition of On the Job. It's great to be here with you in our little studio.
It's so great to be here. I love work. I love talking about work. It's going to be great.
So the idea of the podcast is, people, that we spend so much of our time thinking about work, wanting to improve work, finding new jobs, and just being absorbed in what we do because we love it, hopefully, that we thought, particularly in this day and age, it's time to have a decent podcast. It's all about making your working life better. And that's what we're doing here with On The Job, talking about all aspects of work and the fun bits, the bad bits, the crazy bits, the bits that you've never told anyone in the past. We want all of that to come out in the next months and years as this podcast grows legs and runs, Sally.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking to each other. We're going to be talking to some really interesting guests. And we're hopefully going to be talking to you as time goes on.
Yes, we'll have plenty of details about how you can do that as this podcast starts to spread wings and fly. But to introduce ourselves and get a bit of a sense of who we are, a little game, little parlour game, first job, worst job. So what was your first job and what has been your worst job, Sally Rugg?
Right. Well, my first job coincidentally happens to be my favourite job ever, and that was at a little franchise chain called Boost Juice. And so I got a job at Boost Juice when I was 13 and 9 months, which is the age you can get work
in. Child labour.
In WA. Yeah, they love it. I think I got paid like $4.70 an hour or something mad. And I worked there for a really long time. I worked there for like 8 years and I loved it.
What did you love about it so much?
I loved the, this sounds kind of, it sounds weird, but I loved the sort of manual task of it. It was like enough sort of busyness to do with my hands and your brain, but not too much. And I really, really loved the customers. I was working in the city of Perth, and as a teenager, you know, it was sort of my window into the big wide world, all these different people from walks of life coming in to get a smoothie or a juice. I loved it. I still dream about it like twice a week. Like while I'm asleep, I dream about it.
What are you dreaming? Are you dreaming, oh no, I've read of crushed ice to fill out this smoothie with?
Or yeah, it kind of.
Where are the frozen berries gone? What's happening in those dreams?
It kind of reflects my day-to-day mood. I don't know if you have this, but like if I'm really stressed, it's a stress dream where, you know, the orders are piling up and all the fruit's gone rotten. But if it's like a really peaceful dream, it's sort of like, oh, I'm with all my friends from 20 years ago or 15 years ago and, you know, our favourite song is playing and the bananas are ripe, you know.
The bananas are ripe, the ice is cool, the smoothies are flowing. What was the smoothie of choice in Perth, in central Perth, in the mid-2010s?
I mean, my favourite, you can still get it, I think, is the green tea mango mantra. I love it.
Green tea mango mantra. Mm-hmm. It's a long way from the chocolate thick shakes they used to make at the Dairy Queen in Glenroy where I was growing up, which were, you know, two parts chocolate and four parts dairy whipped cream. You weren't using any soft serve ice cream in those things,
were you? No.
You just turned your nose up at me.
And so this ice cream shop, was that your first job?
No, I did end up working in an ice cream shop. We might bring that up at some stage. That will be quite the story. No, my first job was the classic paper round. The classic paper round.
How old are you?
Oh, here we go. Then play that guessing game. How old do you think I am?
Do people still get the paper?
Well, this was in the 1970s.
Okay.
I was on my little Malvern Star dragster, three on the tree. So it was a beautiful red Malvern Star dragster. Do you know what I'm talking about? Is this a language you even speak?
No. It's a bike, right?
There we go. We've established this was a bicycle. We've had a little gear stick on it, which was three gears, one, two, three. You know? Mm-hmm. And I tie literally roped a wooden crate on the back with my copies of the Herald Sun and the Age. It would have been just the Sun at that stage because it was the morning newspaper and the Age, and just drive right around my neighbourhood with a transistor radio taped to the front of my bike so I could listen to 3XY, the top 40 station, and early in the morning would be slinging newspapers onto people's front lawns.
Oh gosh, that's
earning
so
enough money
wholesome.
To spend it on a Gray Nichols cricket bat, which I'd sort of been eyeing off for months on end, which I eventually got. So,
and what was the going rate for paperboy in the 70s?
That's a good question. It wasn't a lot. It would have been $10 a week, maybe, which wasn't too bad. But you'd have to be up at 5 a.m., 5:30 a.m. every morning, get out there and do it, even in winter as well, which could be in Melbourne, a bit of a slog, but it was worth it when you pulled out that Greg Chappell-looking beautiful Gray Nichols cricket bat at cricket training that summer. So that was my first ever job. Those Saturdays were tough because back then the Age newspaper was just basically the size of a telephone book because of all of the classifieds. So throwing one of those things on someone's lawn was like throwing a brick at their house. you needed to be quite strong to get one of those out. Different days now, the newspapers barely exist, but that was my first job. What was your worst job?
Oh, my worst job. So I did a stint in London in my early 20s. I fell in love with a girl and flew to London to be with her. It's like a very cliche lesbian rite of passage to, you know, move overseas or move cities for the girl you love. Anyway, so I moved to London and needed a job, obviously, and I sort of fell backwards into this job where I was selling gym memberships in a gym in the London banking district. It was kind of like the antithesis of what I loved about Boost Juice, because what I hated about this job was the clientele, like just people. It was a really expensive gym, and so it was just like really rich bankers in the finance district of London coming.
These don't
in.
Sound like your people.
No, it's not my people. And also, like, I like full respect to people who are really into the gym and into exercise. It's something I aspire to do. But, like, I worked in that gym for a year and never worked out once. Like, a gym, it's not my thing. It's not my people. I really felt like I was sort of spoken down to the whole time. But
well, you're Australian, so there you go. You're already on the back foot.
Like, they kind of knew my type, these sort of blow-ins from Australia. But also, like, I was selling these gym memberships that were, like, it's like £300 a month.
What?
Like, ridiculous.
Do you get someone else to do your exercise for you?
It's ridiculous. And this sort of like, we were trained with all these techniques to like close the sale, and you do the, you know, different closes. And I don't know. I'm not made for sales, I don't think.
How long did you last in that one?
I was there for a year.
That's good. That you stuck that out.
Well, I mean, it was during the GFC. Like, I didn't really, I was like, this idiot in London has only ever worked at Boost Juice. an arts degree. Like, nobody wanted to hire me.
My worst job, and it wasn't a fault of either the store that I worked in or the job itself, but more probably a lifestyle issue for me, was I used to work at Meijer as a university student in the food hall. When they had a food hall in the great retail shopping boom of the 80s in a big department store, which was a great place to work. Not so good to be there at 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning after you've been out seeing bands till 2 or 3 in the morning, and your first job each Saturday morning was to clean out the deep fryer.
Oh, my God.
Because the smell of that grease, oh, it was just awful. It was disgusting. You had to pull the lever and open it, and as the oil dripped out and all the scungy bits of, you know, leftover dim sim started to flow, yeah. It had been there since the start of the week. Yeah. That was challenging to the constitution. I used to really find that quite difficult. All my fault. Shouldn't have been out eating VBs until 3 a.m., but I was, as a rite of passage, and the only way I could pay for it was to clean out the deep fryer on a Saturday morning, and there were some rough mornings. There were some rough mornings. It put me off deep fried food for at least 6 weeks. I soon got my taste back for it. Those jobs don't exist anymore. I don't know. They don't have a food hall at Meijer anymore.
No, and I'm surprised to hear that they have a deep fryer in the middle of Meijer. Wouldn't that make all the clothes stink like chips? I mean, maybe that's a draw. People do like the smell of chips.
We're going to talk a lot about work. We're going to have a lot of fun as well along the way. Today, though, we are going to catch up in just a moment with somebody who's a pioneer in Australian sport, but also did something in the world of work this week, which was really interesting. Lisa Alexander, a former Netball Diamonds coach, who put in a job application for a very different coaching job and got, well, a somewhat lukewarm reaction. We're going to talk to Lisa Alexander right after this on The Job.
This is On The Job with Francis Leach and Sally Rudd.
This is On The Job with Francis Leach and Sally Rudd. Interesting news over the last few weeks as the last bastion of male defiance when it comes to equality in the workplace. Well, not the last, but one of the biggest and one of the most resistant, AFL football, mm-hmm. got on the knock on the door from one of Australian sport's finest coaches.
Oh, and I'm sure they considered themselves extremely lucky, let them in. Sat them down, offered them a job?
Not quite the way that it worked out, because this fine coach happened to be a woman wanting to work in a male sport.
Okay.
And the one I'm talking about is Lisa Alexander, a world championship winning coach with the Australian Netball Diamonds. She was in charge of the national team for nearly a decade, and she is one of the finest coaches of any sport anywhere in the world, and she's our very first guest on the job. Hi, Lisa. How are you going?
Going very well. Thank you both. It's great to talk about work.
Now, Lise, when did you first see that North Melbourne job being advertised, and what was your first response to seeing it being available?
Well, I actually didn't see it advertised at all. I ended up getting the CEO's email from a work colleague of mine through Leading Teams, and then I sent off an email to the CEO to inquire what the process was, because, you know, I really wanted to, apart from have a go at this position, also want to inquire about the process, really, and whether, you know, people had been approached for it or... And I remember somebody asking me quite a while ago was when I think I was interviewed by Jared Waitley on SEN whether I'd be interested in coaching in AFL down the track as well as netball or in addition to, and I said, of course I would. It's a sport that I've watched, observed, been immersed in for, you know, my whole life. And I felt that I could bring value to particularly the AFL men's high-performance programs, which are probably in many respects the most suited to the skill set that I've developed as the Australian Diamonds coach over the past 10 years. So that's why I did it. And I got a response from Brady Rawlins, the general manager of football, to say, please put in your CV and outline how, you know, you think your experience in netball will apply to football. And that's what I thought to do. And I was very politely written back to probably within a week, and it said, thank you, but we're really after a senior coach with AFL head coaching experience. Which I can understand. That's not an issue when a particular organisation's looking for a particular skill set for a particular position. However, from the outside, many of my, I guess, colleagues in high-performance sport and people I speak to look at a club like North Melbourne and think part of the issue is that there needs to be a lot of cultural change there. And I thought that my experience could bring that to the club. However, I think they've gone down a different track. They've appointed David Noble to that position, which interestingly, David, I don't think has had a head coaching position in an AFL club before.
Interesting.
But he has had experience in winning programs in terms of other positions within the coaching structure. So terribly interesting, I have to say. I'd like to go back and ask a few questions about really, you know, if they were looking for someone in that area. You know, it would have been great to just have the opportunity in an interview to address their questions.
Yeah, and put your case forward. I mean, I think a lot of us will have questions now as well. And Lisa, for people like me who are maybe into sport but not particularly sort of like, you know, I'm not an expert in sport. And so for someone like me who might not understand how someone who isn't really familiar or like hasn't coached AFL before could transfer those skills over, could you maybe talk through what you bring to coaching, particularly in terms of the sort of holistic way you approach it and how like that actually is a transferable skill?
Yeah, well, coaching is it's a communication process at the end of the day. It's built on many skills, I think, from particularly around analysis of movement and also how that particular person approaches those skills and movements in a sport, and then being able to put all of that together in a team situation and team strategies, which I've had experience of doing in netball my whole life. I have had little bits of experience of doing it in football, but certainly, in particular in an AFL setting, you would have, I guess, your specialists who would be the people who would convey the messages about particular skill sets in the midfield or ruck or the forward play. However, my overall understanding of how a game style can win and how a game plan can be put together and then communicated to the playing group, both from an individual and a group perspective, I'm very experienced in doing, because that's what I've been doing my whole coaching career. And so there are many, I guess what I'm saying is there are probably 70% of that is general. You don't need the actual specific skills of football or to have played football to know and understand that.
Right. Like you're not there telling, you wouldn't be there telling these guys how to kick the ball, but you would be perhaps looking at the strategy of the game and the structures of support staff and the overall culture of a team, right?
Yes, but I will say I can teach somebody how to kick, and I can probably do that better with an elite player than, in fact, a junior, because my experience is being able to teach skills in netball at the highest level, and that was my area of study of human movement and skill acquisition when I was at university. And what I've done is applied those skills in a practical setting in netball, which I believe is highly transferable across to football.
Lisa, when you saw David Noble's appointment, did you feel like North Melbourne had basically led you up a garden path by not offering you an interview, not even having the curiosity to talk to you about the things that Sally and I are talking to you about right now?
Oh, no, they definitely didn't lead me up a garden path as such. I think they probably dealt with me in what they felt was the most polite and professional way possible, but it was a yes, please apply, but really no thanks. We're seriously looking for somebody who's had, you know, massive AFL football experience at the highest level, and that's what they're after, which I believe is only, as I said to you, 30% of what I can bring to a position. And I guess what I'm saying is they've probably missed out on just expanding their understanding and insight into looking at things from a different perspective. I mean, part of the issue at North Melbourne from the outside is there's a lot of misunderstanding about what it takes to win championships now, and getting obviously a list together and getting a training plan and program together that's very, very much focused on winning and also improving the culture, which is not a person, it's an actual, the dynamics of how the team works together. That's where you could say I'm an expert in, because of my experience and success with the Diamonds at the most elite level.
Can I just ask, there are many women's teams, and we've seen this across the AFLW and across other sports as well, where there's no problem when men coach those teams, yet when you look at male sports at a professional level, they're all but absent. I don't think there's any professional male team in this country that currently has a female coach. How do we start to break that false barrier that exists? And I'm sure this is across the work environment, in whatever sector people find themselves in, there's still that structural inequity which is, you know, baked in to the way that we work and the expectations we have of people because of their gender.
Look, I think it's just really a patience and time thing, Francis. If you remember back to, I think it was in the 90s when we had Ansett, we were looking at having a woman pilot, actually the first commercial airline pilot, and it was seen to be, you know, an issue because it was felt that women couldn't be pilots. Well,
we're very
why
emotional.
That?
Very emotional, us women. We wouldn't want to be at the helm of a plane when we get upset.
It was then at the time, but now it's just commonplace to have, you know, women pilots taking control and captains, and they're training other captains now. It's only going to take that one person to break through to show that it is possible and it actually is beneficial, and it could be, lo and behold, it could be successful. That's the issue for me. It's like football is secret men's business, Francis, and people, particularly like myself and very many other women, feel completely locked out of that. Just look at, you know, the Outer Sanctum podcast that the ABC has been supporting for a few years. It took them ages to be taken seriously that they were, a great team of commentators on football. Yes, they're women, but they're passionate about it. They're very knowledgeable and they understand the big picture of football extraordinarily well, and they know their footy. Many women do. We just need to be given an opportunity.
And you called it secret men's business, the world of Australian rules football, AFL, but it's also, I guess, in business and in other areas as well, where men are the gatekeepers to opportunity and to an ability for women to actually improve their professional standing or their skill set. You would have felt that also in the response from men when people found out about your application, that there was a really strong pushback from men who were almost insulted that you'd even consider yourself capable of coaching a team.
Yeah, probably only, again, I want to be really fair to everyone here, it's probably about half the people that commented that felt like that. The other half are actually really curious. And, yeah, this is actually, why not? And actually thought of it with much more of a growth mindset and a glass half full approach and thought, yeah, why don't you have a go? And that's fair enough. That makes logical sense to me. So I have to say it was pretty much half-half. Obviously, there's very much the people who are perhaps used to working in more male-dominated trades and also professions. For example, in our tradies at the moment are dominated by guys. You know, they probably look at me with a bit of suspicion, but they just, All it is the weight of numbers. It's having more women tradies. It's having more women pilots. It's having more women in parliament. And where it just becomes a normal thing, it won't be looked upon with such, suspicion. There's this thing that, how would I address 27 young men? Well, when I answered that question to somebody, I said, well, I did the same thing when I was teaching a boys' class at Wesley College. It's no different to the nervousness I would have felt addressing the Diamond Squad for the first time. Mm. You know, any elite team of people, and I talk about people and humans rather than men and women here, I'm very comfortable, I guess, getting across my leadership skills, my ability to communicate and to clarify and to teach both on an individual and a group basis. Mm. And I've had a lot of experience in doing that, and I've had... You know, I understand what it takes to win. I think that's a big thing that people kind of don't understand. Perhaps they think it's easier because it's netball. I can assure you it's not easy at all. You've got to have everyone working in the same direction, and that's what I'm skilled at being able to do.
Yeah, and for people listening, Lisa does have an extraordinary record when it comes to winning. When you were the coach of the Diamonds, you won, is it 81% of games you won?
Yeah, and it was mainly against the world number two. So the competition is fierce. It's not, you know, one week there's, you know, the bottom of the ladder team and then the next week it might be in the top five. Every single test match that I coach is extraordinarily competitive. It was only at World Cups where we would play, you know, perhaps we might play Sri Lanka, which we did in the last World Cup, who are ranked in, you know, the 30s, where we would have a very easy match. But that was not often. Nearly all of the matches that I had to coach with the Diamonds were tough, highly competitive, high-pressure games, almost like, I would say, an AFL grand final, of three games all packed into 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary legacy, an extraordinary track record, if you will. I think one thing that's true of women's sport and women in sport is that over time, all the assumptions made about women's sport and women in sport are proved wrong. And I think, again, to AFL, about the AFLW season, it must have been the year before last, when there was a discussion about where they would play the final, and, you know, critics were saying, oh, they wouldn't fill up this stadium. And it sold out really quickly. And the support for AFLW has been growing and growing. So, you know, hopefully over time, we'll look back at this moment and think, God, what were they thinking, not getting a woman coach in?
Well, you know, I would have picked you as the first coach every time, Lisa, because I know your track record and I know who you are. I just want to finish by asking you, are you going to have another go? Or do you feel like you'll get a fair hearing next time your application goes in? Is this part of what needs to happen? And once again, not just in football, but in other industries, that just by allowing an opportunity of access. And would you suggest that the people across other industries just just need to accept that interviewing people who at first face value might not present as their archetypal a candidate are missing out on an opportunity to discover something new.
Yeah, I think, you know, doing a blind interview might have been a great idea for this, where, you know, the person's voice is distorted and you can't see who it is, and then be able to compare the candidates that way. That was actually suggested to me by Michael Checker. He said to me, how do you think you would have gone if it was on a blind interview? And when I spoke to him about the idea of coaching in the AFL, first of all, he jumped to the conclusion that I meant the AFL women's. Now, I think the AFL women's need a different sort of coach, somebody who is comfortable with a more development focus, because the league hasn't quite reached the elite standards yet. It will in time, definitely. So, you know, people sort of felt I was being arrogant by not applying for an AFLW head coach position, but I'm not really. I'm just trying to match what I think my skills are to a position. So really what I'm saying is I think we need to look at the way that we definitely appoint people to positions. Are we applying far too much bias to our interview process? And also, are we really investigating the strengths of people and what they could bring to an organisation? Particularly, you know, we know everyone's got to innovate, everyone's got to change, everyone's got to get better at what they're doing to stay in business and to stay successful in the workplace. So we really need to explore all of those avenues of leadership and look at things differently. And young people today are just not going to accept what we've accepted in, you know, the old days about authority. They want to be inspired. They want to work for leaders who they respect and who behave in a really ethical and courageous manner. And I think that means we really need to cast the net wide when we are appointing people, particularly to leadership positions.
Lisa Alexander, you are and always have been a groundbreaker and will be again. Thank you so much for being our very first guest on The Job.
Thank you very much.
I thought it was really interesting that Lisa, just in the closing then, mentioned how she would prefer to go to the AFL Men's League rather than the Women's League, because the Women's League are in more of a sort of developmental stage, which is obviously true. But part of the reason that the Women's League are in a developmental stage is because they all have to work full-time. It's the same thing with the Matildas, and I'm sure with, you know, women's sport across the board. So while the men get paid this huge salary and they're able to train 40, 60 hours a week, women are working as, you know, teachers, labourers, you know, dentists, what have you, and are having to train outside of hours. And so I think another way that we will see women's sport be brought to the same level as men's sport is actually paying these athletes a full-time salary.
It's slowly starting to happen in the netball caper, which Lisa was part of. There are professional contracts, full-time contracts available now because the players can play almost year-round. And also in cricket also is offering that sort of opportunity to women, but they're still very much the outliers relative to all the other professional sports. But it is starting to happen.
It's really interesting with the Matildas as well. Maybe we can try and get someone from the Matildas on, because, you know, the Matildas are Australia's most successful sports team and they're still having this argument overpay.
Okay, you're listening to On The Job and we'll be back right after this. You're listening to On The Job. I'm Francis Leach.
I'm Sally Rugg.
And Sally, it's time for the right of reply, an occasional segment we'll be having on the pod where we look at something about work in the media and maybe have a discussion and reply to what we've written. This one popped up on the radar this week, an article written by Michael Cazole in the Sydney Morning Herald about a couple of blokes who run an organisation or a company called the Mary's Group. Let me just read the first bit of what Michael wrote. Do the youngsters who wait tables and pour drinks at bars and restaurants need a reality check? Absolutely. Say no nonsense, Sydney hospitality gurus. Oh, alarm bells. Hospitality gurus. Oh, wow. Jake Smythe or Smith and Kenny Graham. Mm-hmm. Now, Kenny and Jake have said that that young people have become whining and self-entitled, arguing the industry has overcorrected from its previous tyranny by indulging lazy behaviour and bad attitudes.
So what's their issue?
The pair host a podcast called The Fat. I did have a listen to it. Mm-hmm. I did take in a bit of The Fat and was delighted and surprised to discover that the first episode that I came across was the most recent one, where they literally sit around in a talking circle with some friends in some part of the northeastern New South Wales or southern Queensland after having smoked cane toad.
What's that? I don't know what that means.
They smoked some skin of a cane toad, which has hallucinogenic effects.
What? Is that a thing that people do?
Apparently for our friends here, Jake and Kenny, that's how they spend their time. And then they spend 45 minutes talking about what visions they've seen after they've smoked cane toad. So, maybe they were smoking cane toad when they made these comments.
So hold on. So there's these two, Jake and Kenny, they record themselves smoking a cane toad. What? And then I call
it. Don't knock it till you try it.
I'm not going to try it. And so then I'm going to knock it though. So then, and so they're calling the workers who, you know, create their business, work for them, lazy and entitled.
Let me just run through some of the things they've said on a previous podcast. This was not under the influence of cane toad. Can you test for cane toad? Is that a performance enhancing drug? Don't know. Here we go. From Kenny. It's almost impossible to run a business now without offending somebody. It's almost impossible to run a life without effing offending somebody, he said again. You're seeing it so clearly with this cancel culture behaviour, which seems to be getting some sort of pushback now. I think COVID has given some perspective to life to a degree.
Well, Kenny, if you're listening, if you spend your life offending the people around you, perhaps it says more about you than the people around you. And on a more serious note, like, let's not dive into the cancel culture discussion right now, but I do think that it's really important that when that term pops up that we're really clear about what they mean. And I'm not sure Kenny knows what he means. Like, if he's offending his staff, that's not cancel culture, mate. It's you being a jerk, probably.
Now, Mr. Smith said, the bad old days of abusive bosses yelling at their staff in kitchens and bars needed to change. But today's young workers hadn't suffered through that era. Oh, how long ago was that? About 6 months ago. He hoped COVID would bring to light the reality that, quote, the hospitality industry needs an amendment in terms of relationships between employers and employees that is more based on equity and a fair outcome, and this is the kicker, not a historic overcorrection. So it would seem that these two, the Cheech and Chong of the Sydney restaurant scene, are telling us that workers having gone and discovered that their wages have been thieved by proprietors and owners of restaurants were overcorrecting.
Mm, those brats. I can't believe they're asking to be paid correctly. No, I did actually catch a sort of glimpse of this article yesterday. And I also note that either Jake or Kenny were complaining about how workers these days are really conscious of their work-life balance and how, you know, this has gone too far. My workers keep asking about work-life balance. These guys, in my opinion, sound like they're not the best boss to have.
Smoking cane toad, just keep that in mind. Work-life balance, this is from them. It's one of the most dangerous terms young people have been introduced to. What a frightening idea.
Oh, my gosh. So what are they expecting that the employees of their...
Well, he's got something for you here, Sally. Don't worry about that. The luxury that I got given as a kid in my day was you can choose what you want to be. That was the thing my parents and my grandparents fought to give me. I thought the whole idea was trying to find a job that you loved. So that's your work-life balance. So they're basically saying unless you want to work like they do, which, you know, I understand that hospitality is something of a cult where people want to just spend 80 hours of their week working hard, partying hard, you know, that's their thing. Not everybody needs to or wants to make it their entire universe. But for Kenny and Jake, it seems that that's what it is.
Yeah, and what that also does is it'll exclude anybody who has caring responsibilities, like of any shape or form, people who are studying, people who just sort of want to see their friends or go to the beach and not work 80 hours a day.
You've got a bit of advice also for you when it comes to your days off. They're not only interested in telling you how to work, but how to live. Mr. Graham said young hospitality staff often work 32 hours a week, woke up at midday, went to work at 4 p.m., spent their nights off getting hammered They also agreed that too much time glued to phones and social media meant that many young people did not give themselves the chance to properly unwind during their downtime. Quote, on your days off, just actually put your phone down, Mr. Smith said. Don't respond to the message on the WhatsApp group. Don't check your emails. Stay off Instagram. Actually treat yourself to 2 days like you're on holiday.
The thing, the thing that gets me about these two is that I think they're my age. Like, they're not old men. What do you reckon? You've got a photo of them.
I've got
there.
A photo of them.
Say I look younger.
You look younger than – look, they look like they've lived a life.
Okay.
And one of them's wearing a wife beater singlet that looks like it hasn't been washed for 6 months.
Can you imagine if I showed up to work wearing what that guy
– Take a look.
Yeah. Can you imagine if anybody who wasn't the boss showed up to work looking like that? And, like, I'm not advocating for really strict dress codes, but...
But put a shirt on.
Yeah. Brush your hair if you want.
It doesn't stop there from our friends from the Mary Group, the people that bring you the fat, the podcast. They do go on to offer a few more pearls of wisdom for young workers and young staff. And this one is a ripper. Speaking to the Sun Herald, the Sydney newspaper, Mr. Smith said 100% stood by the remarks that he made in this article and also had a crack at people using mental health as a crutch, saying that genuine mental health needs must always be taken seriously. But too often people used, quote, generalised triggers such as mental health or poor work-life balance as an excuse when it came to work. Quote, it's just this slippery slope, scapegoating your mental health responsibilities. It shows up in poor work ethic, lateness, too much drinking, poor performance at work in general. And here comes my favourite bit, Sally Rugg. Exercise and hard work and diet change really do a lot for mental health. Co-opting blame doesn't. Exercise, hard work and diet change from a couple of blokes that look like Merv Hughes, who's been out on the Terps for a week, lecturing other people. They need to go to that gym that you worked at, pay £300 a week to get someone else to do their exercise for them.
I mean, like, I know we're sitting here having a laugh at these guys. I do feel really bad for their staff, particularly because I've been to Mary's, like one of their burger joints in Newtown, and this is a couple of years ago, but their staff were really lovely. Like, I don't feel like they necessarily need to be embarrassed like this in the press. But more to the point, that mental health comment there is like such a step backwards. I feel like so many workplaces are doing the right thing and heading in the right direction in terms of mental health leave and sort of like a better dialogue about mental health needs. And for these guys to jump into the paper and say that it's all a slippery slope, it's really out of touch. And, you know, I don't want to sound dramatic, but it's kind of dangerous, I think, if you're responsible for a workforce of people and someone is saying, I need a mental health day, and they're getting vilified in the press for it.
And you would think that from an industry that has just gone through a massive crisis of confidence and reputational damage because of the way that it's treated its staff, that coming out and taking a free swing at young workers at this particular point in the cycle of life ain't the smartest thing. It's kind of like being in charge of the Hindenburg and saying the only thing that really was dangerous, not the hydrogen, it was just the towers that got in the way. Extraordinary stuff. I don't think I'll be going back to Mary's anytime soon.
No. I hope the staff are okay. It's pretty mean.
Pay your staff, Jake and Kenny, and get a shirt as well, both of you. Clean up your act on the job.
On the Job with Francis Leach and Sally Rugg.
You're listening to On the Job, Francis Leach and
Sally Rugg.
And our podcast is all about making life at work better. Sally, it's been a great first episode, but before we finish, one of our occasional segments is going to be And Now from Silicon Valley, because we do know that Silicon Valley is the cradle of 21st century genius. And so no doubt there's some great ideas on how to improve working life coming out of that particular little principality of nuttiness over there in California. What have you got for me?
Yeah, and so for people who don't know, although I suppose I think we mostly do, but for people who don't know, Silicon Valley is the name of this sort of area near San Francisco. It's like this hotbed of tech startups, and there's all these companies who are hoping to be the next Apple or the next Visa. And yeah, so in this segment, I'm going to talk a little bit about companies and their innovative startup culture. So these companies are part of this high-tech innovation culture. We're really important parts of life, in my opinion, like the eight-hour workday and permanent contracts are often ditched in favour of ideas like work-life integration, which is where you just sort of, there's no...
Kenny and Jake involved in that.
There you go. And workforce agility, which is sort of like, you know, zero-hour contracts and the rest. And there are some pretty interesting ideas that have come out of these Silicon Valley startups. And one that I think is particularly interesting is... Okay, so have you heard of the Netflix bonus?
No, I'm certainly not getting that where I work.
So the Netflix bonus, it's not like some, you know, secret content page on their streaming platform. Basically, every month, employees of Netflix are offered a big chunk of money to leave their job as a bonus. Like, this is a leaving bonus. And I think it's, the last time I checked, it's equivalent to about like $9,000 Australian. It's this big chunk of change. And the idea being is that they only want people who really, really, really want to work there to work there.
So you're dangled $9,000 at the end of each month to see whether it will tempt you to leave.
Yeah. It's sort of like, you know, it's one part, how much is this job worth to you? And it's the second part, it's that, you know, it's expensive to look for work. And so if there's someone who doesn't want to be there, the company wants to sort of provide them a bit of cover to go look elsewhere, and they'll get someone more passionate in.
I wonder how many people take that up on a monthly basis.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'll have to get back to you. We'll take that one on notice. So yeah, there's some pretty interesting approaches to management and workplace culture and stuff, but there's also some pretty out there innovations, to put it generously. And so I wanted to bring you the top three that I've seen this month, but we're going to do it like a quiz.
Okay.
Okay.
Fire away.
Okay, and the prize is a Netflix bonus.
The supply of reruns of Friends.
Okay, so number one, it's three questions. Question number one, insurance company Acuity has what in their head office? Number one, a pinball machine. Number two, a water slide. Number three, a Ferris wheel.
Oh, I'm hoping it's number two, the water slide. I think that would be the coolest thing ever. I would be taking my $9,000 from Netflix, going to buy myself a pair of board shorts and going to work for Acuity. If you tell me that it's a water slide, please tell me it's a water slide.
It's a Ferris wheel.
Oh, boring.
Why? Yeah.
Just going around the same spot all the time.
It's super weird. They've got a Ferris wheel in their head office.
They could probably take the one that's in Melbourne that's sort of parked down beside the freeway that no one gets on. If you've never been to Melbourne, you'll one day see it if you drive in from the airport.
Maybe they're just telling people that that is their head office. They're like, wow, we've got this amazing Ferris wheel.
They've got a Ferris wheel.
Yeah. Bit weird. Okay.
Just a bit.
Number two. Dropbox, so online storage company, people might be familiar with this one, has what special room in their office to foster their workers' creativity?
What options do I have?
Number one.
I know the special room I use.
Number one, an art room with paints and clay and spray cans, canvases. Number two, a jam room complete with guitars, pianos, drums, microphone. Number three, a dance room with one of those stompy machines from the video game arcade and a ballet bar.
Oh, please be the dance room. Please, so that you can go in there and be Napoleon Dynamite for 5 minutes and just come back out with some genius idea.
It's worse. It's the jam room.
Oh.
Can you imagine? You're just like...
Imagine if you sat next to that room and you hear endlessly someone every day just murdering smoke on the water or trying to play Stairway to Heaven.
You're on a deadline and you just hear from the other room. Anyway, here's Wonderwall for like the sixth time that day. Yeah, a jam room. The horror.
Only boys could have dreamt that up. That is a boy room.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay.
What's the third one?
Number three.
There's more.
You've got none of them right so far. But
I think that's actually testament to my good character and judgment, because they're all batshit crazy.
Okay, so Missing Link, which is a South African company. Just quickly, so this company, what they specialize in is like improving your presentation, like I think like your slideshows.
Oh, your deck.
Your deck, yeah. So they've found a niche in the market. I don't know.
So we can have more decks, because that's what everybody wants in the workplace, more people with more decks.
I mean, it must be profitable because, get this. Okay, so Missing Link has what in their office?
Okay.
One, a shooting range.
They're South African. This is a huge possibility.
Two, a treehouse. Or three, a tattoo parlor.
I'm saying shooting range.
The answer is, it's a trick question, all of the above.
Oh. Isn't go through them mad? Again. What have they got?
They've got a shooting range, a treehouse, and a tattoo parlor.
You sure this isn't a bikie gang?
No. They're going to jazz up your decks. They're going to make your decks better. So, yeah, that's the latest from Silicon Valley.
My final one for you is, which one of those companies, on the basis of that crazy stuff, would you prefer to work for?
Oh, my God. Anywhere that doesn't have the jam room. That's what I'm saying. And, hey, thanks to OutsideOnline.com who helped me find these examples.
Oh, dear. So that's it. That's our first episode of On The Job, Sally. It's been great fun. Shall we do it again sometime soon?
Let's do it again soon. Absolutely.
Yes, it's been fun. So don't forget to subscribe to On The Job wherever you find your podcasts. If you liked it, give it a review. It's a start. It's only the first one. It'll get better as we go along. And let your friends know about us as well. We're brought to you by Australian Unions. And we'll be back for our next edition very soon. On the job.